warm welcome to the latest episode of Spotlight Asia. In this podcast, we want to speak about topics and regions that are often overlooked in German or European mainstream media. We are part of Polis 180, a grassroots think tank on European and foreign policy, and founded this program, Connecting Asia, to stimulate a young discourse on political, economic, and cultural issues in the Asia-Pacific region. Today, we are coming to you live from Nepal's capital, Kathmandu. In today's episode, we are going to look at what has been happening in Nepal since the beginning of the coronavirus crisis. Like all parts of the world, Nepal has been heavily affected by the coronavirus crisis. But on top of this, the country is also experiencing politically turbulent times. In December 2020, Nepal's Prime Minister Oli announced the dissolution of parliament. However, the Nepalese Supreme Court overturned this decision in late February 2021, declaring it unconstitutional. These events have now led to the split of the ruling party. Our guest for today's episode, Supral Rush Joshi, will help us contextualize these political events and give us some insight into Nepal's handling of the coronavirus crisis. My name is Teresa Stuban. I am a member of Polis 180's regional program, Connecting Asia. And today, I'm very happy to welcome Supral, live from Kathmandu. Thank you for joining me today, Supral.
Thank you for having me, Teresa.
Supral is a media and communications specialist, a TV and radio host, and a voice actor. He has a background in international relations and diplomacy, as well as China studies, and graduated from Peking University's Yanqing Academy. As a freelance writer, he has written pieces for the Kathmandu Post, one of Nepal's biggest English-language newspapers. Previously, he worked in radio, covering topics ranging from entertainment to social awareness. And most recently, he has been hosting a Nepali TV show called Quarantine, where he spoke to experts and policymakers on various issues surrounding the coronavirus crisis. Thank you again for making the time to be here today.
It's my pleasure.
We are going to start our episode with a brief introduction to Nepal. Nepal is the largest country in the Himalayan range and has 8 of the world's 10 tallest mountains, most prominently Mount Everest. Nepal is landlocked and shares a border with China in the north and India in the south, east, and west. It has a population of 29 million people and over 100 ethnic groups. Nepal turned from a monarchy into a parliamentary republic in 2008, and a secular constitution was put in place in 2015, which institutionalized federalism in the formerly very centralized country. So, Supral, before we dive into our conversation on the current political events and their background and implications, what is the basic knowledge that our listeners need to have on Nepal and its political system?
A lot of things have happened in Nepal's recent history. So before we start talking about what's happening now, I think it's important to talk about the events that led us up to this point. So Nepal has experimented with a lot of political systems, which I'll get into. So right now, we're facing turbulent times, but I think we're so used to this whole idea of political instability. And it's not just my generation I'm talking about, but my parents' generation as well, who had to go through it. I think when we talk about Nepal's modern history, I would start off from 1950. Before the 1950s, Nepal was an oligarchy. So there was a family that was in power, which called all the shots for 104 years. It was said that when Nepal finally opened to like outsiders, like researchers, and also the general foreign population, when they first arrived to Nepal, they called this a fossil state because things hadn't changed much in the past 100 years. So from 1850 to 1950, not really anything happened in Nepal to the point that it was termed a fossil state by anthropologists. In 1950, for the first time ever, Nepal got a taste of democracy, but it was conditional. It was a constitutional monarchy that we experimented with. So while this nascent democracy was trying to flourish in 1962, the king then decided that this wasn't working. So in 1962, we went from a constitutional monarchy to an absolute monarchy. That continued for almost 3 decades, when in 1990, we had the first ever people's movement led by political parties. So mind you, during these three decades, political parties were banned. So in the 1990s, there was a huge movement led by political parties with massive support from the people that reinstated the constitutional monarchy and also democracy. But even then, there were these underlying issues of inclusion, of minority rights, of how the Nepalese state has failed to include these multiple identities within the definition of what it means to be a Nepalese person. In the 1990s, these agendas were still there, but they were not being properly addressed. That led, in 1996, for a small group of people who were not pleased with the system to take up arms, which was the start of the civil war. So in 1996, led by the Maoist party, the country went into civil war, and that continued on until 2006, when the Maoists actually entered mainstream politics. In those 10 years, a lot of development activities were also halted. There were a lot of lives lost, by some estimates over 17,000, including a lot of civilians. But besides that, there were also important agendas that were brought to the mainstream, especially those of inclusion, minority rights, and even of feminism. So until the Civil War, these agendas were there, but it wasn't a part of public consciousness. After the Maoists came into politics, that was the start of Nepal's transition into a republic. So in 2008, we got rid of the monarchy, and we've been a republic since then. Well, we declared that we were going to transition to federalism in 2008, but for that to happen, it took a long time. It wasn't until 4 years ago, that was in 2017, that we had our local level elections and eventually our provincial level elections and the federal government elections. So as of now, we're still a very young republic and we're still experimenting with federalism. So it's only been like a few years that for the first time in Nepal's history that this very centralized country has decentralized power into smaller forms of government. So that's basically what's happening right now. What you need to know about Nepal, I would say, if I had to put it in one sentence, this country has experimented with a lot of political systems, but is still struggling to manage its diversity. Right now, it's a very young republic experimenting with federalism and figuring things out.
So we heard a lot about political instability being a characteristic feature in Nepal's governance. It sounds like historically, failing to address Nepal's diversity has been a factor that has led to political instability and even contributed to the outbreak of the civil war in 1996. The current political system is trying to address issues around the oppression of minority groups with the institution of federalism and through the constitution. How would you evaluate the effectiveness of federalism and the new constitution in doing so?
The new constitution and federalism, it has taken a positive step towards the betterment of our lives. So I think transitioning from monarchy to the republic was an absolutely important step. So in that regards, the new constitution has been great. Federalism, it could have done better. Right now, yes, administrative structures have changed from like a highly centralized government. We've gone into like three levels of government, like the federal government, the provincial government, and the local government. But the underlying problems still remain to be addressed, especially when it comes to addressing diversity and providing autonomy to more oppressed groups that have never had a say in Nepal's politics. Now, I will go back to the period between 1962 to 1990. In those three decades, this definition of what it means to be a Nepali was created. So this identity of what it means to be Nepalese revolved around speaking the Nepali language in a country that has over 100 languages, 126 by latest count. In a country that speaks so many different languages, to profess your Nepali-ness, you had to speak the Nepali language, which was, of course, the language of the ruling elite. You had to profess Hinduism, and you had to almost not entirely give up on, but it was encouraged to adopt the culture and practices of the ruling elite. So this attempt to create this unified identity, this universal identity of what it means to be Nepali, we're still bearing the repercussions of that as today as well, because even today, even in 2008, once oppressed groups started professing their ethnic identities, identity politics was looked down upon. It was thought that it would create disintegration and disturb the harmony that has existed throughout centuries and that is just part and parcel of what Nepal is as a country, a peaceful, harmonious country. So the people that were in power who wanted to preserve the status quo, they thought that identity politics was a step in the wrong direction, that it would create disharmony, that we did not need rights for these oppressed groups. The new constitution was supposed to address these concerns. These issues, well, still are around when it comes to restoring the dignity of oppressed groups. Those are still underlying issues that have not gotten as enough attention, I would say. There is no democracy without dignity. And right now, I still feel like we're quite far away from that idea of democracy.
This gives us a lot of background knowledge on where Nepalese politics are currently at. Returning to the current situation, as we said, these are politically turbulent times. The Prime Minister dissolved Parliament in December 2020, and this decision was then overturned again by the Supreme Court in February. Could you put these recent events in context for our listeners?
So this is the most stable government that we've ever had in Nepal's modern history. That is because 4 years ago, when we had the elections for the federal government, the UML, the United Marxist-Leninist Party, and the former guerrilla fighters, the Maoists, came together to form an alliance and contested the elections together as the Nepalese Communist Party. They won, got a majority in the parliament, and Nepal had, like, for the first time in its modern history, a stable government, or what seemed like a stable government. These parties are, well, somewhat similar ideologically, but, well, one of them was the leader of a civil war from 1996 to 2006, right? So it didn't really make sense for a party that had led a civil war to form, to not just form an alliance, but actually to merge with a mainstream party to contest elections. It did not make much sense, and it was obvious that it was just for short-term political gain. Even within the party, the distinction between UML and the Maoists is very, very clear, even though they now technically don't exist and are like under the banner of the Nepalese Communist Party. Now, talking about the current situation and the political infighting, going to the details of that, there was supposed to be an exchange of power between these within the two parties that formed the NCP. So the current prime minister was supposed to step down and the leader of the Maoist party was supposed to come in as the new prime minister, but the current prime minister decided to back off from that agreement, which has created this current situation.
I see. Yeah, so basically the situation right now is that the Supreme Court has declared in March that the seats in parliament that were originally the seats of the NCP are going to be reassigned to the original parties, to the Maoists and the UML, respectively. But so far, this government has not formally fallen apart because the Maoists have not yet withdrawn their support for the UML, for Oli's government. And probably in the background, there are currently efforts of both parties to form new coalitions that is currently going on and will probably be the path forward if there are no elections at this point.
It seems like, and I do hope that we won't be having early elections, because I don't think we can afford elections right now, especially because COVID has caused so much damage to the economy. And even now, like, you know, there's a second wave. By the way, we'll talk about this in the next section. But even when talking about, but even right now, I need to mention that, you know, there's this looming second wave of the coronavirus pandemic. So we definitely cannot afford elections. And I really hope no one is considering that path.
Yeah, especially given the current events around the coronavirus pandemic and now a looming second wave, which we will cover in more depth in our second part of this podcast, as you said. It seems to be the worst possible time for such a government crisis. And this state of uncertainty it has been prolonging for 4 months, and there is still no clarity on how things will continue.
So what we are seeing right now with the prime minister declaring that he wants to dissolve the parliament, that decision being overturned by the Supreme Court, but now everything all being in limbo and all being very uncertain whether or not the prime minister gets a vote of confidence, whether the country goes into a fresh set of elections, all this uncertainty is still there. That's mostly because of political infighting. All the other underlying issues that I've mentioned earlier, and also the fact that there is a pandemic that's looming every day, when you look from the perspective of those in power, these are secondary issues, but because political infighting is what's been the priority of every Nepalese government. To put that into perspective, I will also go into Nepal's political economy a little bit. We are an agricultural country in the sense that agriculture still forms 30% of our GDP. Tourism also has large contributions to the economy, 10%. But what's keeping the country afloat, I would say, is remittances. Especially in the 90s, after we had a civil war, a lot of young people decided to leave Nepal to take up like labor jobs in the Middle East. Countries like Dubai, the UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Malaysia in the East, Korea, South Korea, and also Japan as well. So a lot of young people have left Nepal to take up jobs, mostly labor jobs in these countries, and they send back money at home as remittances. And that's kept our economy afloat. Even during the 2008 financial crisis, we did not feel much of the repercussions. We had a massive earthquake in 2000. We had two massive earthquakes in 2015, but the economy was still afloat. And even with the pandemic right now, because the countries that are destinations for Nepalese workers, they weren't closed off entirely. Like if it had been China that we were sending our young people to, that would have been a problem. But because the Middle East, well, they didn't completely shut off. People are still going to work there and they're still sending money home. So that's kept our economy afloat. And that's also not given any incentive for the government, whichever government to come into power, to actually create jobs. Their priority can always be political infighting because there is no incentive. There are jobs, just not at home.
Mm-hmm. That gives an idea of how deep-rooted and how complex these problems are. The remittances really do appear to be a two-sided coin that is, on the one hand, supporting Nepal's economy through times of crisis, but on the other hand, also a factor that contributes to less accountability among politicians and thereby, to a certain degree, enables this focus on political infighting. So when we take this to more of an international level, due to Nepal's geographic location between two superpowers, India and China have historically been competing over influence in Nepal's political life. Do you think that in this current situation, the split of the NCP could have implications on Nepal's relationships with India and China, respectively? And if so, what could these be?
I feel like because we have, like, Nepal has an open border with India, and because the Nepalese economy is so dependent on India, even for basic resources like petroleum, we have to rely on India. India has had a much larger say on how things work in Nepal. We would like to, I think Nepal would always like to have an optional partner to rely on. And slowly China is emerging as that option for Nepal, I think. Especially after 2015, the year that Nepal had two major earthquakes and Nepal promulgated a new constitution, which India had reservations against, and India announced an unofficial blockade, like an economic embargo on Nepal. That caused a lot of problems in our daily life. And that's when Nepal really considered China as an economic and also strategic partner, especially after 2015. I feel like right now as well, China is also wanting to have a say in how things run in Nepal and not just India. Well, we're strategically located between, China and India, and Chinese and Indian relations haven't been so great since the border skirmishes that happened a few months ago. So I feel like both of these powers are competing to gain influence in Nepal. There is speculation that the NCP, the Nepalese Communist Party, the UML and the Maoists, they actually came together because China would want an NCP in place, like maybe almost like a counterpart to the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. So there is some speculation that that happened. And I do feel like China does not want the NCP to go back to its original form with the Maoists and the UML splitting. And also, it needs to be noted that only came into power as prime minister because he took a stance against India. So he rode this nationalist wave and came to power for the first time in 2015, I think, and then again in 2018. So he's always had like an anti-India stance publicly. So publicly, he's had an anti-India stance. But right now, I think it's become very obvious to him that completely completely giving up support on India is not going to help forward his political career. So there have been a few publicity stunts. Even though he's a communist leader, he's now visiting temples and participating in religious activities. This is mostly to please the BJP that is in power in India and which came to power on riding on a wave of Hindu nationalism. So we're right across the border. So these agendas of Hinduism really appeal to our neighbors down south in India. So until 2008, we were the world's only Hindu country. So the state religion was Hinduism. But then we became a secular republic. I think India has, well, not necessarily India, all of India's polity, but the BJP, which is like an obviously Hindu nationalist party, they've never been happy with that decision. And they would sort of want to revert that decision to go secular for Nepal. So right now, you know, when the communist leader, the current prime minister, you know, who's a devout Marxist, starts visiting temples and starts holding like religious rallies and stuff, it becomes quite obvious that there is an underlying message he's trying to send across the border.
So from what you said, I'm assuming that you think it is likely that Oli will continue to be a guiding political figure in Nepal despite everything that has happened now and the sort of scandal around the dissolution of parliament.
I just feel like right now, given the circumstances, given how what a toll our economy has taken, and also the fact that, you know, there might be a second wave of COVID, we can't afford elections. And there's also reports of Oli actually talking to other leaders within his party. So I feel like he's here to stay. For better or worse, he's actually here to stay. But who knows? Things are very, very uncertain in Nepal, and its uncertainty is a feature in Nepalese politics.
Adding another layer of complexity is certainly the coronavirus pandemic, which makes it extremely hard to form predictions on how the future is going to look. Which brings us to our next topic section, the coronavirus pandemic. Nepal had its first confirmed case on January 24th, 2020, but it was only in May 2020 that cases started to pick up. According to the World Health Organization, as of April 23rd, 2021, Nepal has 292,152 cumulative cases of coronavirus, as well as 3,117 COVID-related deaths. To put this in comparison, Germany, which has three times the population, currently has around 11 times as many cumulative cases and 25 times the deaths. Can you speculate on why case numbers in Nepal have been so much lower compared to European countries like Germany?
I'm no expert on this, so probably not the right person to talk about this. But if I had to speculate, I think with the first wave, we were incredibly lucky. We've only had like some 3,000 deaths, which is relatively low compared to anywhere else. It's not because we had like strict measurements in place or anything. I think it's mostly to do with the fact that we're a very young country. Our median age is 26, and most of the people who were initially tested positive for the coronavirus were young migrant workers who came in from India and also from the Middle East. So I feel like because we're a very young country, that has proved very, very advantageous to us, because the coronavirus is known to be more serious in countries with an aging population. There were other hypotheses that were thrown around by experts at the start of the pandemic. One was because Nepal already has other forms of weaker forms of coronaviruses, there might be some sort of cross immunity that we developed. And also the fact that another hypothesis was the BCG hypothesis, the BCG vaccine that is administered for tuberculosis meningitis. It was assumed that that offers some level of protection against COVID as well. And the BCG vaccine, well, fortunately, Nepal has almost universal vaccine rates. So the BCG vaccine is very, very common. Almost everyone in Nepal has been administered with that vaccine. So it was initially thought that that might have provided some sort of immunity against COVID. But that was the first wave. The first wave just went by. Not a lot of damage. But now it's been a week or so, a little over a week, that we're hearing a second wave. Even with the first wave, when cases were rising, there were not many serious cases. So our ICUs weren't overwhelmed as they were in the West, as in the US or in countries in Europe. So our ICUs weren't, there were not many serious cases. But right now we're hearing talk of a second wave. There has been an increase in hospital administrations for serious symptoms of COVID-19. And this becomes quite obvious because you're seeing this in India as well. India is having a huge spike in coronavirus cases, a lot of symptomatic cases, a lot of deaths as well. So thousands, I think 3,000 deaths were recorded in a single day, which is huge. And because we have an open border with India, whatever happens there really has a huge impact on what happens here, because we're so economically and culturally intertwined, especially in the border regions. Right now, as we speak, a few districts bordering India are on lockdown. Kathmandu is still functioning as normal, but we don't know what's going to happen.
That sounds quite intimidating. So what can you tell us about Nepal's coronavirus strategy and how it has evolved since the start of the pandemic?
Right. So a year ago, when we didn't know much about the pandemic, the government decided to put the entire country on lockdown. So I think we were the first country in South Asia to go on lockdown, like the entire country, not just specific pockets, but the entire country went on lockdown for 3 months or so. And Oli was in power back then. During the first days of the pandemic, there was a lot of anti-science banter from the prime minister. He was suggesting home remedies. He was trying to downplay the seriousness of the virus, for which he got criticized as well. But the first wave wasn't so brutal to us. But after the first lockdown ended, there was a spike in cases. So then we had a second lockdown that lasted 3 weeks. But after that, it was a downwards graph. The number of serious cases went down. The number of deaths also went down. It wasn't as bad as it was elsewhere. So perhaps maybe the first lockdown did contribute towards controlling the virus in its initial stage. But what's quite unfortunate is that, you know, even in the past 1 year, there hasn't been almost any improvement in Nepal's health infrastructure. So just a few days ago, there were reports that hospitals aren't prepared to... the hospitals are at the same capacity as they were a year ago. So given an entire year, yeah, we really did not do anything to prepare for the worst.
Okay, I see. So one could say that in the first wave, Nepal luckily wasn't affected very badly, was hit very badly by this first wave. But on the downside, this time wasn't used very effectively by politicians to take precautions to build up infrastructure for situations like these, where we have a coronavirus mutation coming over from India.
Right. There have been vaccination drives, though, so maybe that's a positive. We've had donations from India, the AstraZeneca vaccine that was manufactured in India. It's called CoviShield here. So CoviShield was donated by the Indian government just a few weeks ago. China also stepped in and donated their Verocell vaccine. So there has been a vaccination drive, but it hasn't been administered very properly, I would say. It's not that we have much of anti-vaccination sentiment, but there have been administrative lapses, and we're still relying on donations from like India and China for vaccine. So yeah, vaccine diplomacy is something that's at play in Nepal.
How would you describe the impact that the COVID crisis has had on society in Nepal? Do you expect a long-lasting influence?
Okay, so let's first talk about the first wave, because the second wave is only just starting. With the first wave, I think, well, there wasn't a direct impact. So not many deaths, only like 3,000 or so deaths. But the economy has been very, very badly hit, especially the tourism sector. So now tourism contributed to almost about like 10 to 15% of the GDP on any given year. So that sector has been completely shut off. You know, tourism entrepreneurs are really feeling the bigger brunt of it. Other industries, I would say, are also hit, but it's mostly the tourism sector, because, you know, our agriculture is mostly subsistence and our manufacturing sector isn't that great. The majority of our economy is still agriculture and remittances. So remittances haven't been hit, but the tourism sector has taken a big toll, and also that has consecutively had a big impact on Nepal's economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talking about remittances, I've seen predictions by the World Bank and also the Asian Development Bank, who were expecting a decrease in remittances during coronavirus. However, we've even seen an increase in reality. So this might have provided some degree of respite.
Right. There's the speculation that the people working abroad, because there's so much uncertainty, they're actually rushing to send money home, which has actually resulted in a spike in remittances coming inside the country.
Mm-hmm. So we are approaching the end of today's episode. Supral, would you share your outlook with us, like your general outlook? We've heard a lot about various challenges that Nepal is currently facing. Historically grown problems and just a young political system. What is your general outlook?
I think becoming a republic was a step in the right direction. I think the monarchy was really holding the country back. I remember my fourth grade social studies textbook telling me that the monarchy was a reincarnation of God. So, you know, we grew up with these problematic ideas. And I think getting rid of the monarchy is a step in the right direction. Right now, because federalism doesn't seem to be working, a lot of people would actually revert back to the old system. And there are pro-monarchy groups that sometimes hold rallies despite coronavirus being around. Am I optimistic? Well, I think we have taken a step in the right direction. You have to understand that we're still a very, very young federal republic. We're still experimenting with federalism. There is still, administrative coordination between like the federal government, the provincial government, and the state government still seems to lack. We still need to form better laws. Sometimes provincial governments haven't been able to adopt federal laws into their domain. So that's something that needs working on, but I am positive. Obviously, federalism could have come in a better form. Federalism, the new federal structure could have addressed historical grievances. I think it, in a lot of ways, has failed to do that. But this is a step in the right direction, I would say. In the future, I would like to see more autonomy being given to oppressed minority groups. Redresses for historical actions that haven't been very conducive to the growth of cultures and languages, and that have created an ethnic hegemony in politics and economy. So I would like to see that being addressed in the future.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this. We have a last closing question before we wrap up today's episode. What do you wish people were aware of about Nepal that they are not, in your experience?
To the average foreigner, well, the first thing that comes to mind when they think Nepal is Mount Everest. So then they tend to think that we're a country of mountains. And well, they're not entirely wrong, but there is great diversity in topography in Nepal. It's not just that we have mountains, like our highest point is Mount Everest, 8,848 meters, but our altitude then drops to 60 meters above sea level as well. So we have plains in the south, we have mountains in the north, we have hills. Well, maybe by foreign standards, these hills would also be considered mountains. But adding to the topographical diversity, there's also great diversity in terms of people. So we're not just one people. So there's lots of ethnicities, lots of people, over 100 ethnicities, speaking like over 100 languages. So it's a very, very incredibly diverse country. I think the average foreigner tends to think of as like one group, one culture, but there's incredible diversity. So I wish that, foreigners, or even our listeners listening in on this podcast right now, what I wish they would know about Nepal was like, you know, there's more to Nepal than just mountains. Not just in terms of like our geographical diversity, but also people as well. It's a really, really diverse country. And the biggest challenge has been managing that diversity.
That is a theme that has reappeared constantly throughout our conversation today. So thank you. I think these are excellent closing words. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, Sipral.
Right. Thank you again for having me, and thank you to Police 180 as well.
To our listeners, if you would like to learn more about Police 180 or our speaker, you can find the links in the description as usual. We hope that you will stay with us and listen in on the next episodes of our podcast series, Spotlight Asia. Thanks for being here, and see you next time. This Polis 180 podcast solely represents the author's opinion and does not speak for Polis 180 as an organization. Polis 180 is a grassroots think tank that translates scientific insight for political decision makers. We introduce our generation's ideas, analyses, and solutions into the political discourse through innovative and inclusive approaches and develop real alternatives for constructive foreign and European policy.